Welcome to Consumer Choice Radio. We are broadcasting on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM in the morning, every Saturday at 10 o'clock. And our podcast is always available on consumerchoiceradio.com. It is the 11th day of April in the year 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Yael Osowski, broadcasting to you from Vienna, Austria. And on the other side of the microphone, all the way in Toronto, Ontario, I got Mr. David Clement. David, sir, how goes it?
It's going well. Another week, more lockdowns, more quarantines, but we're holding up. I hope you're doing well amidst all the craziness.
Yeah, I have to admit, I've got this amazing circumstance where I'm able to order Amazon packages and online stuff, and it's telling me it's going to take 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, but it shows up in like 2 days.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, lucky. So I think they're just catching, you know, their behinds a bit, making sure that they're not going to give you false readings, or maybe some things are very much delayed, but basically everything I've gotten has come incredibly early, and that's been awesome.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Nice. Yeah, I mean, I think what they're probably doing is just trying to hedge their bets a little bit in terms of not over-promising and under-delivering. They're kind of doing the opposite. They're under-promising and over-delivering.
Yeah, and I think, you know, because they are hiring people like crazy in order to, you know, fulfill the demand, I think it's probably getting a lot more efficient. I know that they are limiting the amount of items and things. There's actually a very good clip. I don't know if you heard this. I didn't know we'd be going right into a clip, but there is a question about what are essential items from Amazon and what are not. Did you know about this?
I didn't, but I would love to hear this clip.
Small setup. This is there are some angry Amazon warehouse workers. They are upset that people are ordering non-essential items. So let's go ahead and hear this.
They should not be selling non-essential items. If you go on the website, all the essential items are sold out. Until you restock and until you close this building, shut it down. Dildos are not essential items. Books for kids, yes, but dildos? No.
No. So that made its way around the net a little bit. Dildos are not essential items, but still apparently readily available on the Amazon.
There you go.
Right now.
I think it's the big question is what environment are these people working in? Are the people picking orders in close contact with other people? Like, are they at risk? Are they not at risk? I think what is and what isn't essential should be as broad as possible under the context of the risk associated for the people who are actually fulfilling the service.
Yeah.
Rather than picking products that the government, I mean, that's a pretty hilarious example, but in the UK, I forget who it was. I think it was somebody linked to law enforcement or something along those lines basically said that they were considering going through the grocery store aisles and looking at people's carts to make sure that they were only buying essential items. And it's like, well, okay, why is that necessary? Are they worried that people are taking too long in the stores? Are there too many people in the stores? There seems to be a variety of solutions that could be done.
That sounds like work, like they're just giving work to police officers, you know?
Yeah, I mean, let's not go down the route of policing what's in people's shopping carts, please and thank you.
Smart. There's a lot of these stories, and we'll get into the lockdowns. I think there's been some pretty interesting criticisms now. You know, I'm very lucky, though, living in Austria. We're the first hashtag free country to lift the lockdown. First European country, first in Europe and North America. And yeah, it's starting next week. So right after Easter, they're going to open up small shops that you're able to go to. You still need to socially distance. You are required to wear face masks and gloves when you enter. I think they're limiting the amount of people that can be in the shop at the same time. So it's small shops, it's garden centers, you know, so the equivalent of Lowe's and Home Depot, these kind of things. And then the hairdressers are the week after. And then we got bars and restaurants and all of that somehow with social distancing. So it's going to be a very interesting experiment.
Yeah, I mean, that's, for a lot of people, that sounds like something that's months and months and months and months away. Walk us through, like, what is the justification for that? How are they justifying it? Like, what's their process in terms of deciding what is and what can and can't be open? How does that work?
I think what was most interesting, and Austria is a very different case. It probably is similar to Canada in that you have, you know, the capital city, you have the big city, and you never really had the number of cases that you had throughout the rest of the country, specifically mm-hmm. in the ski huts. Apparently, one of the epicenters for infecting a lot of people around Europe was this ski lodge that was in Tirol in the western part of Austria. So there's apparently one of the bartenders there or something was getting everybody infected, and everybody was doing shots and playing beer pong and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And apparently a lot of people got infected there. So it was very bad there in the west, Innsbruck, Tirol, these areas. But the city of Vienna, not so much. I mean, there are still, let's say, overall 800 cases. But that's pretty small for, you know, 1.8 million people. Mm-hmm. So I think it's because it was very spread out. I think because the measures were done very quickly and they weren't really done, there was no hesitation. It was just like, okay, guys, we're closing all the shops starting, you know, whatever, next week, and social distancing. We're just keeping our grocery stores open. We're keep the vulnerable populations going in early in the morning in the grocery stores, this kind of stuff. And they were the first to implement this mask policy. I think that helped. Also, the curve, so-called, has been pretty much flattened. Hospitals mm-hmm. have not really been at capacity like many other places, specifically Italy and New York, this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think that was it. It's a smaller country, so they're kind of able to do that relatively easily. But yeah, it's a welcome change. You know, we'll see. And the thing is the government has a rule whereby if all of a sudden the numbers start to tick up, then they'll just slap it on again.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so what is the first thing that you want to do with your newfound freedom when it comes into place?
Well, I'm going to be interested to see what small shops means and who's able to open. Mm-hmm. You know, in the neighborhood that I'm in, there aren't as many sort of storefronts as my old neighborhood. So I won't be able to just go hang out at, you know, any of the stores I wanted to hang out at. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot. I need to go to the hardware store. There's just obviously people stuck indoors. You know, you want to improve stuff in your house or your apartment. You want to, you know, put things up on the wall, or you need some tools. You know, there's only so much you can order on Amazon. Sometimes you don't need to, if you want to use a bolt or something, it's not prudent to use Amazon to do that, you know, to use your Prime Now for that.
Prime Now.
Yeah. So
Prime Now.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to it. You know, we'll see. It's an interesting experiment. I mean, there's a lot of these lockdown measures that are just now going into effect for a lot of people for the Carol Baskin's virus. So, you know, things are, yeah, ticking up in a lot of places. We'll see. Boris, thankfully, I believe, is out of the ICU in the United Kingdom, I heard.
I did hear that. Yeah, he is apparently on the mend, knock on wood. And so hopefully things continue to look up for him, because that got scary for a while.
That's true. That's true. And before we dig into that too much, we do have a guest coming on the program that David was able to interview. Will you tell us just a little bit about that, David?
Yeah. Yeah. We had the pleasure of interviewing Corey DeAngelis, who is a school choice scholar, super entertaining and enlightening guy, talking about why school choice matters, some of the ongoing debates in terms of why school choice should be embraced by those who care about education, and as well as some funny examples of some of his recent scandals that he's uncovered in terms of politicians who are against school choice publicly, but who are in favor of school choice privately. So definitely a good interview teed up for our listeners.
It's a strange world out there.
Yeah, looking forward to that. That's an avenue that we haven't really gotten to cover too much on this program, but obviously is very, very important for a lot of parents and a lot of people. School choice, there's a lot of good things that are happening in some areas because of the Carol Baskin's virus, but you know, in other places, not so much. So it'd be cool to hear his insight. Yep. So I do have a couple clips, David. I got a couple articles I wanted to go to. Here you are listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker 106.7 FM, consumerchoiceradio.com. We talked a little bit about the virus stuff. I do want to transition over to the political scene. I know you wanted to talk about this, and unfortunately we had to wave goodbye to another dear candidate.
I am once again asking for your financial support.
So I think, yeah, the news broke, and apparently Bernie Sanders is gone?
Yep, Bernie Sanders has withdrawn from the race, which makes Joe Biden the presumptive nominee.
Goodness, okay, so yes. A couple of 70-year-olds facing off against one another to become the next president of the United States. Wonderful, great.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, who would have thought that this was the best the U.S. political system could produce in terms of two people squaring off to be president of the United States?
Yeah, wow. Okay, well, it'll be interesting. I don't know if there's been some back and forth, but any good takes that you've seen on this so far?
Yeah, the best tweet I saw was from Chris D'Elia. I think I pronounced that right. He's a comedian. And he's like, breaking, Bernie Sanders has just dropped out of the race. And then his own commentary was, now we're just waiting for both Trump and Biden to drop out and everything will be okay.
That's good. I think he was Harrison in You, the Netflix show, right?
He was, yes, he was, yeah.
Yeah, okay, good connecting. Yeah, I mean, this is like a funny thing about what we're living through right now is that you have a lot of these comedians and, you know, interviewers and stuff. Like, they've been doing stuff online and for a while, but now you're seeing, like, network news anchors that are quarantined at home in their lush living rooms and kitchens and stuff. It's been hilarious to see, because some people are, like, doing a very good job. They have good lighting, you know, good mic. Dress nice. Other people's just like slob. Like just didn't even care or has no clue how to work the webcam.
No. Yeah. Is in their pajamas and on the couch. And you're like, oh, okay. Well, that's one way you can do a CNN program, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know, we're doing a radio show and podcast. And hey, I guess everybody can get in on the medium. Why not? Come on in, guys. Yeah. The water's warm.
Exactly.
So one thing I wanted to hit upon, because this is, I started to listen to a lot of my friends and family and, you know, hearing their stories and, you know, this is what you kind of do. You check in with people. The unemployment crisis that we have now is just off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the amount of people who are now out of work just because things have been shut down for a couple of weeks. And I think there was an article in the New York Times, I think you might have mentioned this to me as well this morning, is the amount of healthcare workers that are being laid off around the country because they're not doing these, you know, elective surgeries anymore or a lot of treatment and people are not going to the hospital. I mean, this is insane. You have tens of thousands of health professionals being furloughed or laid off. It's like, it's not what you would think that would happen when you have like a health crisis, right? I don't know.
Yeah, it's weird. It, and I know that you and I offline have chatted about this a little bit. It raises some questions about where all of the traditional illnesses have gone. So the New York Times had a headline basically saying, well, where did all the heart attacks go? And there's no real reason to assume that there would be fewer now. Over the last, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks. And so part of the concern is that you have this mass exodus of patients who would otherwise be going to the hospital who aren't now because they have been discouraged from doing so, which may or may not make sense, but are also maybe scared of going because they're scared of the possibility of contracting the virus. And so it opens up some good questions. I mean, the fact that if there are hospitals who are laying off employees, that makes you scratch your head. But I guess it makes sense because the doctor who does eye surgeries is not going to be working because my assumption would be that all of those surgeries got bumped.
Yeah.
To free up space for dealing with the virus.
I don't know if it's doctors necessarily, because I think if – I'm totally ignorant here, but you mm-hmm. know, if even if you are an ophthalmologist or something, you still did med school, you can still help out and triage and stuff. But I guess sure. it's all a lot of the, you know, nurses or I don't know, radiologist or something like this. I'm sure it's a lot of these guys who, you know, these are very big professional positions. And mm-hmm. the reason I brought this up is, you know, I have friends who work in the kind of healthcare industry, more in the ancillary industries, you know, finance and stuff like that. And yeah. these are not entry level jobs. These are like well paid, very professional jobs that, you know, have very big career ladders and stuff. And a lot of these people are being furloughed. And I don't know. I mean, we're able to, at least with our work, you know, we're advocating for ideas and trying to talk about this stuff in media and lobby. So I guess it's a bit different, but this is having a huge impact on normal people. And it's not just, you know, servers. It's people across the entire economy. That's pretty worrying to me.
Yeah, it's not just I think the thing that would be worrying is that it's not just the businesses that have been told to close. It's now spreading into industries where you would assume that there wouldn't be mass layoffs. I mean, for the service sector, having mass unemployment when all of those businesses aren't allowed to operate makes sense. I mean, the government is telling the business owners that they can't stay open. But for people who work at a hospital, it leaves you scratching your head a little bit to see maybe how deep this layoff crisis is actually going to be and how much worse it could possibly get, which I think is a really scary thing, because I think it can only go so far before you really start to see turmoil and unrest when people are relying on the government for funds and the ability to get funds to people and what that looks like for their quality of life and all sorts of other various questions. And so I think generally speaking, things are okay right now. But if we're in this type of situation where the numbers continue to tick up over the next 2-3 months, we could be in some serious trouble. I mean, I don't know. I know. I think it's in the tens of millions of assistance applications in the U.S., starting to rival the percentages that were seen in the Great Depression. So
wow.
Problematic in terms of a trend, and hopefully something can be done in the short term to get the economy going in a way that doesn't increase risk of spreading, because obviously you don't want a second wave. But at the same time, if there are low risk activities that people can do or low risk employment situations that people can carry out, maybe let's consider what it would look like to get those people back at work so that folks can continue to obviously make money and pay bills and not have to lean on whatever the assistance programs are. I'm not a doomsdayer or someone who's super pessimistic, but at the same time, the trend here is pretty worrisome.
Yeah, specifically with just the amount of people who are, you know, everyday professionals that have very good degrees and are finding themselves without work. You know, it's not something you would expect when you're in the middle of your career. But we will talk about the lockdowns a bit more. Let's get our colleague Bill Wietz on, who has mm-hmm. written a couple articles on this lately. Mm-hmm. He's very vociferous on the topic. And there's a clip that I have. Did you watch the movie The Big Short?
I did. Yes, okay, I did. Great movie.
So let's play a clip here. I actually pulled this from BNN up there in Canada.
Oh, great.
This is a clip that features one of the characters, or someone, obviously the real person that the character is based on from mm-hmm. The Big Short. Let's play the clip.
We wanted to flag for you a story that's on our website this morning about Michael Berry. Michael, someone who rose to fame as one of the central characters in the book The Big Short, which then was a very popular movie with Christian Bale playing the character of Burry. He has decided to start using Twitter. And over the last couple of weeks, Burry has been tweeting specifically on the issue of COVID-19. His posts are largely critical of the lockdown measures imposed by governments during the pandemic and their growing impact on the economy, despite the fact that more than 9,300 people with COVID-19 have now died in the U.S., and the country's top infectious disease expert has warned the death toll could climb into the hundreds of thousands. As Burry told me in an email over the weekend, I joined Twitter because I was deeply saddened by a national shut-in that is devastating the livelihoods of Americans in many ways. Now, if you're not familiar with the backstory on Michael Burry and his investment ahead of the 2008 financial crisis, he worked with a lot of those Wall Street banks to create products that allowed him to bet against the housing market. And recently, he had been telling Bloomberg again that he had been placing some bearish bets against the market, in part because of the COVID-19 uncertainty, but it even predates that. Late last year, he had spoken to Bloomberg about his concerns that the rise of index funds and passive investing had created a bubble in that market.
Speaking of an anchor guy who's doing it from his living room. Okay. but yeah, this is interesting. The Twitter account is Michael J. Burry, B-U-R-R-Y. I know you floated around this link. Very interesting. I mean, he's using a lot of figures and graphs and showing that essentially, you know, if this goes on for 2 months, basically small businesses are like, they're going to be totally decimated here. And he's saying this has gone on. It's impacting way too many people, not because of the Carol Baskin's virus itself, but because of the lockdowns, the shutdowns. The lockdowns of not being able to serve your customers. I mean, I had this. We ordered from a restaurant that was allowed to open, picked up the food and all this kind of stuff, and they gave us a roll of toilet paper and some sparkling rosé, and they said thank you for ordering because you know, most of their money is made dining in, so they have had to switch to the takeout game, and that's the only way they're surviving right now.
Yeah, I mean, when there are things or areas where I am outside of my kind of own comfort zone expertise wise, so I love to find experts that I can lean on for advice, and for somebody like him to come out with this is a pretty damning statement in terms of how bad this could get economically. I mean, like for people who haven't watched The Big Short, you should, because it basically outlines how this guy made a ton of money betting against the housing market and seeing the bubble that was created and all of that jazz. So if he would be an interesting voice to listen to in terms of understanding where things are going or where they could go if we let them get as bad as possible. So
yeah,
certainly an interesting perspective from him.
Yeah, so we're going to link to some of the tweets in the show notes at consumerchoiceradio.com. You can find that. Drop us a note as well, hello@consumerchoiceradio.com, if you have any other topics that we missed or other links that you want us to discuss. And I figured now would be a good time. I don't have a jingle, unfortunately, but let's talk defund who.
Yes. Yeah, let's talk about defunding the World Health Organization.
So this is something that our organization has been very loud about for a number of years. I mean, we had the domain, we had the campaign, the graphics. We did an entire sort of press conference series, you know, in multiple cities. This is something that we've discussed, good God, I mean, in many different contexts. Back then, it was talking about the Ebola crisis and how the World Health Organization had basically bungled that because they were focusing way too much on non-communicable diseases, things like obesity. They've been focusing on tobacco control, going against the vapors. And then earlier this week, we have none other than President Donald Trump, who lays down this ditty.
The WHO, that's the World Health Organization, receives vast amounts of money from the United States, and we pay for a majority, a biggest portion of their money. And they actually criticized and disagreed with my travel ban at the time I did it, and they were wrong. They've been wrong about a lot of things, and they had a lot of information early, and they didn't want to do very... They seem to be very China-centric, and we're going to put a hold on money spent to the HO. We're going to put a very powerful hold on it, and we're going to see. It's a great thing if it works, but when they call every shot wrong, that's no good.
So is the time to freeze funding to the WHO?
No, we'll dot that, but yeah, very powerful hold. I love that.
Yes, yeah, every action is very powerful or strong or bigly.
Bigly. And there's been, you know, I just got an email here from Politico that's apparently a lot of U.S. agencies and departments are being told that if they are due to send funds to the World Health Organization, that they just, you know, skip out on sending the money this fiscal year. Let's wait it out, starve them out.
I mean, I love it. We have an organization, so we have this international body that, I mean, is created for the right reasons. It's created to help the world respond to global health problems, but at the same time, it's a global organization that puts people like Robert Mugabe as their goodwill ambassador, spends almost $30,000 per employee on travel, that closes the media out from sessions, that is completely anti-transparent, that seems misguided in terms of what they want to focus on. And where this really, what this pandemic has really kind of exposed is that the WHO spent so much time targeting everything from video games to vaping, while it should have been focusing on actually preparing the world for a pandemic. And then it made the situation worse by buddying up with the Communist Party of China in the process. And basically puppeting their narrative for the first 2 months at least of the pandemic, which ultimately made the global response much worse. And so not only were they ineffective, they were ineffective in terms of their ability to respond, and then they actively participated in making it worse.
Oh yeah,
and so I think it's totally legitimate for Trump to take a step back here and say, "Hold on a second, we're not getting our money's worth here. Let's reevaluate and let's see if there can be some structural change in terms of how the World Health Organization operates."
Yeah, and you had Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. I think this was on Wednesday night. He also was present there at the press briefing and just said, like, look, they haven't delivered on what they're supposed to do. So what are you supposed to do? They haven't accomplished what they intended to deliver on. So, yeah, what do you think? I mean, it reminds me of a clip from a movie, Office Space. Remember this? You ever see Office Space?
I did, but I'm...
You have no clue. So, you know, you have the World Health Organization. They're supposed to be the, you know, the big brains on fighting pandemics. And it's like, guys, what are you even doing? Like, you have this whole thing. You have all these we talked about this back in, I think, January when we launched the radio show. They had all these tweets when we were in Davos just going against vaping, saying, oh, it's worse than smoking. And you have to, like, sit down with the World Health Organization, the guy, and just kind of, like, ask him,
what would you say you do here?
I mean, really, what are you doing? What are you doing? You have missed the ball. You definitely missed the mark on this. You told Trump that it was actually racist to do the first travel ban. I mean, not necessarily that we agree with travel bans, but, I mean, come on. I don't know. Drop the ball. Defund World Health Organization. We actually launched a petition on change.org, so just go to defundwho.org. You can sign the petition there. It's actually, we're getting close to 500 signatures already, and we just launched those like a couple hours ago. So it's picking up. People following it.
It's just insane how poorly the WHO has performed, and so I hope that anyone listening can check out that petition, check out some of the just crazy figures about how wasteful the organization is, and hop on board in terms of lending their name and support to the campaign.
We were for defunding the World Health Organization before it was cool.
Yes, exactly. Actually, we have tweets and Facebook posts from well over a year ago that says, rather than targeting video games and vaping, the World Health Organization should be preparing the world for the next pandemic.
Oh, we have memes. We have memes.
Yeah, which at the time, people may have been like, well, next global pandemic, what are you talking about? And then, bam, here we are. And and the WHO is caught with its hands in its pockets doing nothing.
It's a strange world out there.
Indeed. So definitely check out our website, defundwho.org. I think this time, David, we'll go to your interview that you conducted. We'll give us a nice little intro and throw it to Jamie when you're ready.
Yeah, so we had the pleasure of hosting Corey DeAngelis. Corey is the director of school choice with the Reason Foundation, an entertaining and enlightening guest. And so, Jamie, play the clip here. All right, we're very excited to have our next guest on the program, Corey DeAngelis, who is the director of school choice with the Reason Foundation. If you don't already follow him on Twitter, I highly recommend that you do. He is both entertaining and enlightening. Corey, thanks for joining us on Consumer Choice Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Great, great. So, I mean, school choice it's a pretty unique subject. It's important to a lot of people. But what drew you to the subject? What made you want to pursue this as your area of expertise?
Yeah, it's just a couple of things that drew me towards school choice. The first was that although I went to government-run schools all throughout my K-12 experience, mm-hmm. I was able to go to a public magnet school for my high school. And for listeners who don't know, magnet schools are still run by the government or run by the district.
Yep.
But they are not. You're not residentially assigned to a magnet school, so students can choose to opt out of their residentially assigned government-run school and go mm-hmm. to a magnet school. So I went to one, and it was a highly rated magnet school. And the school that I was supposed to go to, based on where I lived, was not a very high-quality school. And so that really opened my eyes the idea that everybody should be able to have options like these. Everybody mm-hmm. should be able to pick a better school, and your zip code and your residence shouldn't determine your future and your educational success. So that's one thing that drew me towards school choice, just that personal experience. Mm-hmm. But then also I did my bachelor's and master's also in San Antonio at the University of Texas at San Antonio.
Okay.
And I did economics degrees, and yep. I just thinking about the school system from an economist's perspective, it really makes sense as to why the U.S. education system isn't performing really well. And a lot of it is because of that residential assignment creates a lot of monopoly power.
Yeah.
Just imagine if, you know, I mean, right now in the current system, if you want to get out of the school that you're residentially assigned to, you essentially have to pay for two schools if you want to go to a private school, or you have to move houses, which is really costly
yeah.
if you want to go to another district school in most cases. So that creates a lot of monopoly power, which as from an economist's perspective is a bad thing, which leads to lower quality and higher costs. And I think that's what explains a lot of our issues.
So, I mean, we talk about consumer choice issues all the time. It's usually about consumer goods, like what we have available to us, the products that we have, the importance of free trade, all of that. Why do you think that there is a bit of a disconnect when it comes to the value of choice, when we compare the cars that we pick to drive and our education opportunities? Like, what are the justifications for limiting someone's school choice to their zip code? Or what does the other side have to say that makes education so fundamentally different, where the ideas of choice and competition don't apply?
Well, they do apply. Education is a service, and, you know, we allow for choice with higher education. Why don't we allow for choice with K-12 education? We mm-hmm. allow for choice with pre-K when we have universal pre-K programs. Mm-hmm. So why don't we allow, you know, K-12 choice? We allow choice for K-12 for the wealthy. They pick their schools. So we already have a market for education that functions at every level, mm-hmm. Regardless of the traditional system or not. But I do understand that the other side does try to make arguments to protect the monopoly that the status quo holds. And mm-hmm. their argument is that, you know, education's different because it's really important is one thing.
Yeah.
But look, food's really important. That's a basic necessity. Food is more important to my life than education, because if
very
I don't
good
have
point.
Food, I die. But no one wants yeah. us to be residentially assigned to government grocery stores. That never works out. So similarly, we shouldn't have people residentially assigned to government-run schools either. We can still fund education through the government. You know, if we see that there are positive externalities to education, there's social benefits to having an educated populace, well, then we should allow people to pick their schools so they can actually get a good education. That would lead to not having residential assignment. That would lead to allowing for private schools to thrive and to not protect the monopoly. But again, none of the arguments to protect the status quo are actually make any sense logically. It's just a power grab. And that's unfortunate for students because it means that they are forced to go to a school that doesn't have a very strong incentive to do the right thing and educate them well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the incentive structure is built more to just perpetuate what they're already doing and have that kind of path dependency rather than inserting maybe some obviously more competition, which increases, in my view, the dynamic nature of education in terms of how it can change and adapt. And you probably, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming that in these scenarios, we see education setups that are a lot more agile and can shift to changes in best practices and newer, more innovative ways of teaching students both new content, but teaching people old content in new ways.
Yeah, so just like think about other publicly provided services or just publicly funded services that we have in the United States. For one example, we have food stamps. Mm-hmm. First of all, they're for the least advantaged, but just imagine if we had food stamps for everybody and that everybody had to use those food stamps at a government-run grocery store that they were residentially assigned to. That wouldn't make any sense whatsoever. But if you imagine that system, that's exactly what we have with the education system today. And people fight, you know, people protecting the public school monopoly will fight really hard to not allow you to take that funding anywhere else to a non-government run school or even a different government run school that you're not residentially assigned to. That doesn't make any sense. That would be akin to arguing you have to use this food stamp at not private grocery stores, government run grocery stores. You can only take them to food kitchens. You can't take them to Walmart. You can't take them to Trader Joe's. That wouldn't make any sense. And everybody knows that doesn't make any sense. But like you were alluding to, we do have systems in some states that allow people to get away from this residentially assigned system and allow people to take their child's education dollars to the best school possible. And so almost all the states, I think 45 or 46 states have charter schools right now. So kind of like the magnet school that I was talking about that I went to in Texas, charter schools are similar to that in that they're still public schools, but they are privately independently operated.
Yeah.
But students are allowed to, you know, take their education dollars there. And then we also have states with voucher programs such as North Carolina has three private school choice programs, one being the Opportunity Scholarship Program. It allows kids to opt out of their residentially assigned government-run school and take some of that funding, I think about half, to a private school of their choosing.
Okay.
And this breaks up that monopoly system, and it really makes the system student-centered instead of system-centered.
And what do we see outcome-wise in terms of a state like North Carolina and some of those programs? Do we have any data on how things are going in terms of results or outcomes?
Yeah, and so if you look at the private school choice literature overall, it tends to be positive, especially when you look at non-test score outcomes. And I think that's because parents really care about things like character education of their children, the safety of their children.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the satisfaction studies on private school choice, every single one of them that I've seen, I think there's 18 random assignment studies that look at satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
All positive. So people like being able to choose different schools, and that varies. The reasons for choosing those schools vary. Sometimes it's based on getting better standardized test scores. Sometimes it's based on more safety. Sometimes it's based on citizenship education. Sometimes it's character education, staying out of gang activity.
Yep.
But if you look at like North Carolina, I think there is one rigorous evaluation of that North Carolina Opportunity Scholarship Program. It's recently peer reviewed and published in a journal called AERA Open.
Okay.
And the main author there is Anna Egalite at North Carolina State University, and her team found large positive effects of the Opportunity Scholarship Program in North Carolina on students' math test scores and also their English test scores.
Okay.
She didn't find any evidence of any negative effects on any of the outcomes that she looked at. But this is the only rigorous evaluation I know that's specific to private school choice in North Carolina, and it's a very large positive effect. Mm-hmm.
And so shifting, I mean, no, that's really good to hear that there are some kind of seen positives in terms of North Carolina's example. On a macro, on the macro side of things, looking at the United States as a whole and then as 50 states, which state is the best when it comes to school choice and the opportunities that parents and students have yep. to decide where to go to school?
Yeah, it depends on how you want to measure, you know, what the best in school choice actually looks like, because yep. you can have a lot of kids using a school choice program, but if the program's super highly regulated, I would argue that's not a really pure form of school choice.
Sure.
But based on the data that we have out there right now, Arizona seems to have the highest percentage of kids using either charter schools or private school choice programs. Mm-hmm. And I think Florida is the second highest share of students using some type of school choice mechanism. But I will say North Carolina is at one of the top of these lists. If you define school choice as the amount of the population using homeschooling options. So mm-hmm. in the United States, only 3% of the school age population identifies as having a homeschool setup. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty consistent from state to state. But when you look at North Carolina, about 8% of the school age population is identified as a homeschool student. And okay. second place is below 4%. So North Carolina is way higher than any other state as far as homeschooling goes.
Interesting.
And I think this could lead the way. And I mean, I think this is a good argument for North Carolina to go after a universal education savings account, because yep. education savings accounts are kind of like vouchers that you can opt out of the public school and get some of that money. But with vouchers, you can only use that at a private brick and mortar school or a virtual yep. school, but you can't use it for homeschool expenses. Yep. But with education savings accounts, you can do that. And I think North Carolina has an education savings account program, but it's a very small program targeted to students with special needs. Yeah. So we should allow every family that wants to homeschool to be able to do so. And I think, you know, after this whole COVID-19 blows over, I think a lot of families are going to realize that they like homeschooling.
Yeah.
But obviously lower income families are going to have a barrier financially
yep.
To homeschooling, even if they like it. So I think that's a good argument in North Carolina to have this homeschooling option, education savings accounts to cover those expenses.
Moving from kind of the more serious stuff to some of the funnier stuff with you on Twitter and some of the what I would call dunks you've had on some folks who are against school choice. Can you just tell our listeners pick one or two of the mm-hmm. bigger scandals, or however you want to describe them, mm-hmm. that you've uncovered and really drummed up on Twitter about school choice, and maybe some hypocritical
definitely.
Politicians out there?
Yeah, if you look at the Educational Freedom Institute website, we actually started a map called the School Choice Hypocrisy Map.
Okay.
Because I was finding so many of these politicians who exercise yep. school choice for their own kids, but then fight really hard against, you know, having school choice for less advantaged families,
yep.
voucher programs or charter schools. And the first person I discovered was Elizabeth Warren, who was mm-hmm. running for president of the United States. And it was really interesting because Education Week did a survey of all the politicians that were running for president and asked them where they went to school and where they sent their kids to school. Elizabeth Warren's campaign responded about where she went to school. They said, oh, well, Elizabeth Warren went to public schools in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And she taught at public schools, but they remained silent. They said, we have no comment on where she actually sent her own kids to school. So I did some digging on Ancestry.com and found that Alex Warren, her son, who's now about 43 years of age, actually went to elite private schools starting in fifth grade all the way through 12th grade in Austin, okay. Texas. Pennsylvania.
Wow.
And this actually blew up because Elizabeth Warren lied to a voter's face on video about it, maybe because she didn't know that I'd already figured this out and wrote about it in mm-hmm. the post.
Yeah.
So that was a huge, you know, unfortunate uncovering for Elizabeth Warren. But then also, since we're talking about North Carolina earlier, I also uncovered Roy Cooper. Governor Roy Cooper
yep.
is pretty strongly against private school choice, the voucher program in yep. North Carolina, but then he exercised school choice for his own kid. And I discovered that online as well and discussed it. I've also discussed it with Nick Gillespie over at Reason Magazine in a video as well. But Roy Cooper, you know, he also lied in one of his videos, or he may have not known the truth. So I don't know if he was actually lying or if he just didn't know, but he said something that was incorrect. He said that we don't know how these kids are doing in the program, but that's not true because students who use the vouchers, their schools have to report standardized testing results to the state, and their schools also have to report graduation rates for those students to the state as well. So it's not true that we don't know how these kids are doing. We do know how these kids are doing.
Of course.
And I mean, when he sent his kids to private schools, how did he hold those schools accountable? Well, he voted with his feet. If they, you know, if they didn't serve his kids well, he could have pulled them out. So, I mean, why not let low-income families do the same?
And that's exactly what I was just going to say. It's incredibly frustrating to see school choice for me, but not for thee, when it comes to these wealthier politicians who will rally on about what they call public schools and others call government schools. We can get into that. But we'll rally on for public schools while they opted out of public schools. And so it's like, from my point of view, when it comes to school choice on vouchers and things like that, this is just a logical extension of the freedom that their wealth has afforded them, but now giving it to low-income Americans across the country.
Well, in an interview with the president of the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers union, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Warren, I think in November 2019, the video came out right after I uncovered the fact that her kid went to a private school, fifth grade to 12th grade. She told Lily, president of the NEA, that, well, everybody should just keep their kids in the public schools. And, you know, even if the public schools are failing, we should, you know, everybody should just stay in those public schools and fight to make them better. But that's not what she did.
No.
She didn't keep her kid in the public schools and fight to make them better. And that's like saying, oh, well, you shouldn't be able to take your food stamp from Walmart to Trader Joe's because, you know, then you're going to drain funding from Walmart and you should just make Walmart better. That doesn't make any sense.
No, of course not.
I shouldn't have to justify where I'm spending my food stamps or my education dollars, you know, based on whether the school I'm leaving or the grocery store I'm leaving is getting any better or not. But Elizabeth Warren failed her own education purity test, you know, essentially by doing what she told others that they should not do. Another argument that's made by Warren and others is that school choice defunds public schools in some way. But when people pay for private schools out of pocket, they defund the public schools as well, because public schools are based on, their funding is based on enrollment.
Yes.
So when Elizabeth Warren took her son and put him in a private school, well, the public school he would have went to had a lower enrollment, and so decreased funding by the same amount as if she would have used a voucher program to move from that public to private school. It's the same financial effect on that public school. So that argument doesn't work either for the school choice hypocrites.
I mean, the hypocrisy there is infuriating. One ongoing debate is about language, about public schools versus government schools. And you've come down very firmly on maintaining the reference point of calling them government schools. Mm-hmm. Other people have called them public schools. Can you give us just a brief synopsis of that debate and why you are kind of holding the line at government schools?
Yeah, they're government schools. They're not public schools in any sense of the word. They're run by the government. They're mm-hmm. funded by the government. They're regulated by the federal, state, and local governments. They're not public because they're not open to all members of the public. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't live next to the school, too bad, you can't go to that particular school. So it's not open to the public, like a public park.
Yeah.
It's also not a public good. That's more of an economist coming out in me, but you know, a lot of people call schooling or a public good, but it's not, because it's rivalrous and exclusive. So it fails the public good argument as well. But essentially, look, it's run by the government, operated by the government, funded by the government, regulated by the government. They are government schools. And, that's just the most accurate term to use. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't call them public schools if they're not open to the public.
Yeah, I think that was the biggest one. And seeing some of your funny exchanges on Twitter, it was like people are saying, well, they're public. And it's like, well, I can't send my kids to that school or that school or that school. So are they really public? And that highlights the paradox there is that it's not like a park. It's not like something that's just open to all taxpayers. It's or all citizens. It's very limited. You are confined to a residential area for most people if they don't have school choice options or if they don't have the means to basically double pay and go to a private school.
Yeah, so, and my typical response is, look, government school is the most accurate term because of everything I just laid out. Mm-hmm. If you don't like the fact that I'm calling it a government school, instead of getting on me about why I should call it a public school, even though it's not open to the public, you should look in, to yourself and ask yourself why you're so upset about me calling it a government school.
Yeah.
It's probably because people know that government usually doesn't do a good job at things.
They yeah.
Do a good job with the DMV or delivering the mail.
I was just going to say that when I hear government, I think waiting to get my driver's license renewed.
if you understand that and you understand government doesn't do a good job at things, then why do you want government running the thing like education that's super important?
Yeah.
I don't want them messing up my kids' education just like they mess up the mail and the DMV service.
Yeah.
There's no reason for government to run schools, just like there's no reason for government to run grocery stores. There could be a public interest in funding education.
Sure.
That's not the same thing as operating actual schools.
Of course. All right. Well, Corey, thank you very much for joining the show. We really appreciate it. We'll definitely have you on again to chat about school choice, because this is an issue that is becoming more and more prevalent with each passing day. And thank you for joining Consumer Choice Radio.
Cool. Thanks for having me. This is America.
Welcome back to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker, 106.7 FM. What we just heard there was an interview that David put together with Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation on school choice. Super important topic. These are the kinds of stuff that, whenever schools are back in session, it's going to be very pressing in many states and definitely here in North Carolina and many other places. So it was great to have him on the program. Great job, David.
Yeah, great to have him. We'll definitely have him back. And we'll definitely have him back to talk about any other scandals that he uncovers about politicians, whether they be Elizabeth Warren or the governor of North Carolina, talking about how terrible school choice is without realizing that people know that they sent their children to alternative schools. So a great guest, friend of the show, and we'll have to have him back soon to chat about how school choice is developing as the political spectrum reshifts to normal conversations in a post-COVID-19 world.
Welcome to Thunderdome.
So next, David, I've got a couple of links I wanted to throw your way, things that are interesting. Yep. Let's do some headline readings here. Coronavirus-related layoffs hit health tech startups. Big deal. That's happening a mm-hmm. lot. U.S. alcohol sales increase 55% in 1 week amid Corona, Carol Baskin's virus pandemic.
Yep. I mean, that doesn't really surprise me. It's twofold. A lot of jurisdictions have really old prohibition-era laws, and so it makes it difficult for people to access alcohol conveniently, and so what they do is they just mass purchase. And so that's a trend that we see in jurisdictions that are more heavily restricted. I mean, I know that, and you can correct me, was it Delaware or what state was basically pulling Pennsylvania drivers over for buying alcohol in their state?
Yeah, this is that was in the state of Delaware. So Pennsylvania shut down all of its liquor stores, of which they
terrible
have
idea.
A monopoly. And Delaware cops, whenever they see those Pennsylvania plates, pulling people over. I mean, who do they think they is? Who do they think they are? Canadian police?
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But I mean, what a terrible decision by Pennsylvania authorities to close alcohol retail outlets. I mean, it's ridiculous from the perspective of consumer choice, but it's also problematic from the perspective of harm reduction, because, and this is what a lot of what I would say compassionate public health experts have pointed out, is that obviously there are people who unfortunately have addiction issues. And when you take their addiction away, and in this case, it would be alcohol, they go through withdrawal, and withdrawal can often require hospitalization. And so you're basically creating a situation where you're generating new patients by bad policy. In the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a shortage of beds. And so, yeah, it's just a nightmare of a policy from Pennsylvania that has all of these other terrible externalities.
Now, let's talk positive. Here's a headline from Reason Magazine. Mm-hmm. New Wyoming law lets local ranchers sell cuts of meat directly to consumers.
Ooh, beautiful.
I mean, I just got the grill fired up hearing this. I like the shift. I mean, Wyoming, you probably get some very, very good meat there.
Oh, you probably get some great, I mean, great cattle.
Oh, yeah.
So you can probably get all sorts of fresh fresh cuts. I mean, my wife and I actually just ordered from a wholesaler who doesn't traditionally sell to consumers because they sell to high-end steakhouses in the area. And they've shifted their model during the pandemic to basically open up to consumers directly if you buy in bulk. And just delicious steaks, great meat, stuff that you would pay an arm and a leg for at a restaurant. And now you have the opportunity to buy it. And so it's great to see some relaxing of legislation that allows for more direct-to-consumer transactions. Those are always appreciated.
That's lovely. Yeah, if we could have that with the alcohol stuff, even better as well. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were able to just order your alcohol and have it delivered to your home and, you know, then got it right from the distillery, right from the beer maker. You didn't have to go through middlemen or distributors or, you know, what a world we'd live in. Direct to consumer. I mean, look, this is the prime world we're living in.
Prime now.
I mean, why prime not? Now. Why not extend this to any and all products? And we've made this case. David, you and I have both made waves talking about having alcohol delivered and cannabis delivered to our doors. I mean, the consumer revolution is here. It's unfortunate that it is happening during the, you know, Carole Baskin virus time, but, you know, there's some positive things, I think, to look forward to. Things are shifting and consumers are getting empowered. That's lovely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a great thing. It's a great thing. And now the big test will be what happens after.
Yeah.
What are we going to do after? Are we going to allow for consumers to still have all of these access points once the pandemic is over? And that's where folks like you and I come into play, because we really have to keep legislators' feet to the fire to ensure that they don't bring back these dumb regulations that never should have been passed in the first place. So there will be lots of work for us to do in a post-COVID-19 world to make sure that these little wins of freedom that we get are maintained and kept.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, David. We're coming up towards the end of the program here on Consumer Choice Radio. David, you got any good articles coming out, other things you're following in the news, or things that people can look forward to on our website, consumerchoicecenter.org?
Yeah, so we did just have a big win in Ontario, in Canada. The government announced a new round of business closures, and we're going to be closing all cannabis retail outlets. So cannabis is recreationally legal, obviously, in Canada. And we made the argument that they should allow for delivery from retailers and curbside pickup. And after careful review, the government actually reversed their policy. And now these retailers are allowed to deliver to consumers, and they're allowed to offer curbside pickup. And so a big win for us. Really love when legislators are open to hearing criticism and can adapt to it. Not a lot of politicians are, as we know. But yeah, that's another big win for our mission and what we do.
well, the revolution will be coming to the rest of us as well. We hope in North Carolina, we help in many other states. You can find out way more about those efforts. We actually now have freethebooze.com.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go to there and see our whole campaign on alcohol modernization. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that is making all of our lives a lot better, more convenient. You know, we have to continue on. That's what Consumer Choice Radio is all about. That's what our mission is. That's why we sit down and do this show and put it out over the airwaves every single week, David.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you to everybody for listening and tuning in. And until next week, we hope you stay safe. Stay safe out there.
Yep. Put on your masks, wash your hands, do all the best, and stay positive. These are good times. Keep listening to us. Our website is consumerchoiceradio.com. We're broadcasting on the Big Talker 106.7 FM every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern. You can subscribe to the podcast, whether it be on Apple, Overcast, or Spotify, the platform of your choice. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week. All the best.